Can we start? So today we begin first of two lectures on DNA damage and repair. Often after this set of lectures, I noted an increase in the number of people wearing hats. In fact, I myself put on a hat walking over here. Because there are many forms of DNA damage, such as sunlight, that introduce a lot of lesions that have to be repaired. And when you think about them, you begin to worry. So we'll talk about these common types of DNA damage, and we'll talk about all the repair systems that we have that can take care of this damage when it occurs at low levels. So just thinking about the chemical nature of DNA, there are a few obvious ways that this polynucleotide chain can have deviations from what it should. One way is to have a mistake in DNA synthesis, as we talked about. That won't give a damaged base, but it will give the wrong combination of bases paired with each other, right? Turn it up.
I think I'm trying to move this up.
Better? Okay, thanks. So mistakes in DNA synthesis are a form of DNA damage. They're not a damaged base, but they're a combination of bases that's incorrect. So if DNA pol 3 or DNA pol delta or epsilon incorporates a C across from an A, for example, and the 3' to 5' proofreading exonuclease activity doesn't lop it off, then and polymerase activity continues, there will be a mispair. So that's a mistake in B-form DNA. But there are also a lot of mistakes that are in the structure of the base or the backbone itself. So bases undergo a wide variety of chemical reactions, some just with water, right? Deamination is, in fact, we'll go through in a minute, it's just water addition across a bond. Other chemical agents like methylating groups and oxidizing groups, things in our food, things out there in the natural world, or the non-natural world, can modify our DNA quite readily. In addition, the glycosidic linkage and the phosphodiester linkage, you will remember from lecture one, I pointed out to you as highly reactive bonds that can add water across them, and then addition across the glycosidic linkage, water addition across the glycosidic linkage removes the base, right? And water addition across the phosphodiester bond leaves a nick in the backbone. There are also double-strand breaks in DNA caused mostly by ionizing radiation, like what you get when you walk outside. In addition, there's UV light damage caused from sunlight that comes in the form of intra-strand or inter-strand covalent crosslinks. So to spell out what I mean by this, there's a picture down here. Intra-strand means within a strand. So what that means is 5' to 3' prime on one strand of DNA, the Watson strand, two of the bases are chemically cross-linked to each other. Inter-strand cross-link means across the strands. So a base in the Watson strand is cross-linked to a base in the Crick strand, right? So these chemical cross-links, these covalent bonds, such as this pyrimidine dimer shown down here, which is an extremely favorable reaction in the presence of light, will take a base and make that base physically attached to another base. So for example, here's a cyclobutane dimer of T, where these two carbons on this base and these two carbons on this base are now covalently bonded to each other. This is common. This didn't change the T, right? But this obviously can't rotate 36 degrees, right, around this B-form DNA helix. So this is extremely disruptive for B-form helix geometry. It can't stack properly as a base pair on the next base pair. So this is just a list of some of the very common types of DNA damage, and the next slide also has a couple more. This is not chemistry class. You're never going to have to draw that. You don't have to draw that thymine dimer. You don't have to draw any of this happening either. But it's useful for me to have drawn it up here on this slide or to take it from a textbook so we can think about what the damaged systems are going to have to repair. So spontaneous wear and tear commonly involves events that I mentioned before, like deprionation, So a guanine, or an adenine, connected here into the backbone through its glycosidic linkage, is very labile to the addition of water across that glycosidic linkage. And when water adds across that glycosidic linkage, the base is released, and the backbone remains intact, but it's deprotonated, so there's a base missing. We call this an abasic site. Sometimes people say apyrenic if it's missing a purine, or apyrimidinic if it's missing a pyrimidine. Now, this, you can imagine, is accelerated anytime this glycosidic linkage is free to rotate, as it would be in single-stranded DNA. So putting this, constraining it into double-stranded DNA, actually reduces the chemical reactivity of this bond. So it's really good that the cell tries to keep your DNA double-stranded. But even so, there's 1,000 or 10,000, depending on whose paper you read, of these bases lost per day in each one of our cells. So deamination is another example. Hydrolysis here of the base itself gives you a change in hydrogen bonding donors and acceptors on the base. So in fact, deamination of cytosine gives uracil. So then what happens, this is uridine right here now, except for that it's in a deoxyribose backbone context. If it were in a ribose backbone context, this would be a normal base. But in deoxyribose backbone context, in DNA, this is not a normal base. But it's still an intact base, right? So somehow that's going to have to be gotten rid of. Now, a point to note here is that in us, there's a methyl mark that's very commonly introduced, one of these intentional methyl marks. So E. coli has 6-methyl A, which most eukaryotes don't necessarily have. We have 5-methyl C. So in 5-methyl C, what's happening right here is this 5-carbon has a methyl group on it, right? Now, if this 5-methyl C deaminates, it makes T with that methyl group. This is a normal base, right? Thymidine is a normal nucleoside. So every time one of these deaminates in our genome, it in fact makes a normal base, T, but that base is paired with G. So again, we're left with a mispair. These are really different sorts of challenges for the cell to have to repair. They are very different, because in one case, there's a correct base, just a wrong pairing combination. In another example, the base is there, but it's a damaged base. And in a third example, there's no base there at all. In other examples, there's breaks or crosslinks, and each of these needs a different level of repair. So we're going to cover several types of repair mechanisms. And the way to think about these repair mechanisms is in increasing order of the complexity of the problem. So the simplest possible fix will be done. If there's a very common damage that the cell can fix simply without spending too much ATP, it will do that. But if it can't fix it simply, it's going to pay the ATP. It's going to pay the complication to fix it, because it's the genome, and it has to fix it. So we're going to cover these in what I think is the increasing order of complexity of the problem. Direct repair, which actually is a chemical reversal of the damage, which is not very common, except for a couple very frequent base modifications. Then base excision repair, often called BER, when one base is missing or altered. Oligonucleotide excision repair, or NER, when the damage is greater potentially than one base missing. Damage is great enough to distort B-form DNA, but the damage is only on one strand. This might be bad damage, but at least there's a strand left behind to serve as a template for the repair reaction. Mismatch repair is more complicated. So mismatch repair is when both bases are okay, but their combination is not. Somehow, there's a template on both strands, but whichever strand you pick, you have 50% chance, if you think about it, picking the right one, 50% chance of picking the wrong one, unless you have a very clever repair mechanism, because there's template, but you're not sure which template is right. But then there's other examples where there's damage to a strand, and the other's not present. Let's say damage has been replicated over by DNAB helicase. And the polymerase comes to fill in that template. And there's damage in that single-strand template. What's to happen, right? There's no good template. And likewise, repair of a double-stranded DNA break. How do you get the information for which ends are supposed to paste back together and whether there's stuff missing in between? So all these will become clear. And we'll start with direct repair. So in E. coli in particular, something about their living environment makes them extremely sensitive, and us too, actually, to oxidative damage. So oxygen we need, and oxygen is bad for you, because oxygen is highly reactive. So E. coli, in fact, has a direct repair system to deal with this conundrum. Guanine, in particular, is very frequently oxidized. So this nice group right here, which was off the 6 carbon, right? But it's the oxygen, it's the O6, so we call this O6-methylguanine, because there's a methyl group stuck to what was previously a nice hydrogen bond acceptor right here. And now that is not true. So G, instead of pairing with C, when G is converted to O-methyl G, it will in fact pair pretty well with T. But this surface, right, of the base has been altered. This is very common damage, and also it's deleterious in the sense that if it's not removed and the cell is replicating, the genetic code will change because the next generation, T will become incorporated, right, instead of C. So as a safeguard to get rid of this particularly dangerous form of DNA damage, E. coli encodes a protein that's called a methyl transferase, because that protein transfers this methyl group to itself. So this enzyme can only repair this one form of DNA damage. It can only repair O6-methyl G. So it's not very versatile, right? But this is a common form of damage, so it's worth it. However, this is in fact a very expensive form of damage because there's a cysteine in the active site of this methyl transferase that takes this methyl group, regenerating the guanine. So this is why this is direct repair. No breaking of the base off the backbone, no breaking of the backbone. The enzyme came to this damaged base and took the methyl group to return the base to normal. But in taking this methyl group, in making this a very favorable reaction, in making it favorable for this methyl group to come to its active site, when adding the methyl group to the guanine was favorable in the first place, this reaction has to be even more favorable, right? If this is going to occur spontaneously, this has to be made even more favorable. And so it turns out that this methyl group attached to this cysteine side chain can't be removed. This reaction is made so favorable that, in fact, there aren't cellular ways to get rid of that. And this whole protein with this methyl group stuck to it is degraded. So if you take the definition of enzyme, it's not really, right? Because it doesn't regenerate itself. That's really expensive to make a whole protein for that. But in the evolution of E. coli, it's clear that they kept this enzyme because it paid off. So you can see that this direct repair should be saved for special cases. And special cases, like this O6-methylguanine in E. coli, do exist. However, very few damages are repaired by direct repair in the sense of the broad scope of the number of kinds of damage. The rest of the repair mechanisms are much more versatile. They're not sequence specific, right? That direct repair reaction, that was sequence specific. This is not. This is called base excision repair, and it's the next step up. So another really common form of damage is this setup here, where it's drawn such that a base is missing on this strand. So here's the intact backbone, and there's a base missing. So this is what would happen, for example, if glycosidic linkage hydrolysis depurinated this site, right? But in addition, this type of structure is also intentionally created by some enzymes as the first step in a repair reaction. One common form of damage was the deamination of C to make U. So here's a U in DNA. Because it's a spontaneous chemical reaction, it occurs at some frequency, and it's recognized. So in fact, there's an enzyme, uracil DNA glycosylase, sometimes called UDG, UNG. But glycosylase is the important thing here. Glycosylase, what's it going to do? It's going to cleave the glycosidic linkage intentionally, right? So this glycosylase is going to cleave the DNA containing uracil such that the uracil is released at the glycosidic linkage. So this turns into this. And that's useful because this is a substrate for base excision repair, right? And so this is a very general kind of repair that's needed. So the first step in repairing a U would be this uracil DNA glycosylase. The base leaves, and you're left with an abasic site. So this abasic site has to be repaired. And in step two on this board, the first thing that you have to do should be obvious, because you can't just put a base back in there. The units of nucleotide incorporation are DNTP triphosphates, right? That's what we got. That's what we got to use for this process. So first, we have to get rid of this part of the backbone where the sugar and phosphate remain, because we can't fill in this with a new nucleotide until the sugar and phosphate are also missing. So this is the job of enzymes called AP endonuclease and phosphodiesterase. There are other enzymes that can do the same task. These were the ones that were first discovered. So what's an AP endonuclease? Okay, you know what an endonuclease is. It means it's going to cleave the backbone of the DNA, right, without requirement for an end. So endo, anywhere within the DNA chromosome, can have a cleavage by AP. So A is the apurinic again, right? So AP endonuclease cleaves the DNA backbone at sites where there's a base missing. That's pretty logical, right? And by cleaving the backbone, it's now marked the spot for repair. The phosphodiesterase is one type of enzyme that can then remove the linkage, because the endonuclease just breaks the backbone. It doesn't take away the ribose and the phosphate that are there. So the phosphodiesterase enzyme is specialized for removing that single sugar phosphate unit. Okay? So AP endonuclease and phosphodiesterase work together to remove the sugar phosphate, leaving you this. Now this is a spot. It's a little gap. It's a one nucleotide gap, right? And a one nucleotide gap with a 3' hydroxyl and a 5' phosphate. So the 3' hydroxyl, though, at this gap, can actually recruit polymerase. And DNA polymerase can initiate repair synthesis from the free 3' OH. There's not a landing pad for single-stranded binding protein here. It's just a single nucleotide. So what polymerase is going to heal this? E. coli. Paul 1. Yes, Paul 1. Question.
Can this mechanism be used to fix just depurination? Or does it have to start at step 1?
Good question. So do you have to start at step one for these to act? What's the answer to that question? Can you just start here for these to act? That's the answer. Yes. Everyone's nodding their head yes. So these enzymes, right, they see this. They don't care whether this came from UDG or whether this came from spontaneous hydrolysis across the glycosidic linkage. So this is why this is clever, because other glycosylases, of which there are probably many, can funnel into the same downstream parts of this pathway. Okay? Good question. All right, so after DNA polymerase acts here, done? No, we're not done. Because the backbone has been broken by an endonuclease that didn't conserve the phosphodiester bond energy, so we need to call in DNA ligase to restore the integrity of the backbone. Okay? So DNA polymerase and DNA ligase are all required in this pathway. So uracil DNA glycosylase, UDG. Is there ever more than a one nucleotide gap? So right here, the answer would be no. But as soon as you load DNA pol 1 at this nick gap, what can happen? It's got a 5 prime to 3 prime exonucleus activity, right? So in fact, DNA pol 1 can chew up this strand and in fact replace a lot of the DNA at the lesion. But this only works for things that are single base mistakes, okay? So I'm pointing out again that you could have predicted something about the mechanism of action of this UDG, because UDG has to recognize a uracil. How does it know? How does it see explicitly the uracil? It has to check the entire hydrogen bonding donor and acceptor surface of that U. And the way that it does that is the same way, right, that the methylating enzymes work that we talked about, which is to take this DNA here with the uracil in green and pop the uracil out of the double helix into its active site. The protein is in this light lavender stuff, in ribbon. In that manner, it can hydrolyze the glycosidic linkage quite readily in its active site. And as soon as it does that hydrolysis now, it no longer has particularly high affinity for this DNA and it dissociates. So it comes, sees the uracil, hydrolyzes it, and dissociates. So clearly, this works when one base is mutant. These glycosylases, they pop one base out of the helix into their active site. But what happens when more than one base is damaged, right? How are you going to fix that problem if there's two consecutive bases that are damaged? And the answer to that is to take one step up in these repair pathways to nucleotide excision repair, or NER. So NER will act when there's enough damage that the backbone of B-form DNA is distorted, right? Like that pyrimidine dimer with cross-linked T's, intra-strand pyrimidine dimer, that's a really common substrate for this pathway because the backbone, the geometry of the B-form DNA is off, because two bases in a row have been damaged. But this will only act if all the damage is on one strand. So there are very bulky groups that get covalently linked to our DNA. Those distort B-form geometry, UV crosslinks. We'll come back to some natural compounds later. So NER then begins with a situation where the backbone on both strands is intact. And for example, in this illustration, these two consecutive pyrimidine groups have been cross-linked with this little hat, okay, covalently cross-linked as a pyrimidine dimer, intra-strand pyrimidine dimer. First thing that has to happen, of course, is that something has to recognize this distortion of B-form DNA. And in E. coli, the machinery for that was discovered through mutating strains so that they became UV-sensitive. So genes were found that conferred UV resistance, because we walk outside, UV, plenty of that 260 nanometer light, causes these crosslinks. So if you just leave your E. coli in a plate exposed to the sun, right, you need these genes to grow well. So these are the genes that encode UV resistance in E. coli. So they are labeled UVR, the proteins, A, B, C, and D. UVRA, in fact, is not only the first letter, it's the first protein in the pathway. So UVRA and UVRB come together as a UVRAB complex. This is the current thinking. And that UVRAB complex recognizes the distortion in B-form DNA. So UVRAB will bind here, right? But again, the thing that's going to have to happen to get rid of these damaged bases is there's going to have to be a break introduced in the backbone, right? You got to do it, and you have to break the backbone of this strand. So for that, this says excision nuclease. You know that it's going to be an excision endonuclease, right? Because it has to come to DNA in the context of intact chromosomes. And the excision endonuclease, or just the endonuclease, UVRC, is the protein that does that. So how is UVRC specialized to be this endonuclease? Let's see. How would I specialize UVRC to come to pyrimidine dimers? Well, you would be right if you said that UVRC interacts with the UVRAB complex, right? So this is another one of these stories where there are things that load nucleases or helicases or polymerases. So UVRAB, you can think of as the loader, if you want, for UVRC. Because when UVRC joins the scene, UVRC has an active site that will produce a NIC, a break in the phosphodiester backbone on one strand only. It's not recessive. Okay? It's not an exonuclease moving along. It is merely an excision or incision, if you want, endonuclease. It makes the cut. So this is going to tell you, because what's drawn on this slide is that there's a cut here and a cut, a nick here and a nick here, that UVRC is going to act twice. And lo and behold, you'd be right. So you can imagine UVRAB bound right there, and then a molecule of UVRC binds and nicks here, and then a molecule of UVRC binds and nicks here. And in fact, this recruitment is so uniform in structure that in E. coli, every one of these bits of damaged DNA that's excised is 12 nucleotides, sometimes 13, but it's 12. Okay. So this distance is determined by how UVRC sits down on UVRAB. UVRC is not sequence specific. It's not even structure specific. It's not recognizing that pyrimidine dimer. It's merely coming there because UVRAB is there. Right? So this nuclease is specialized by its interaction with UVRA and B. Wherever it gets recruited to the DNA, it will place that nick. So the excision nuclease will nick here and nick here. That's UVRC's task. But in fact, this 12 base pairs is pretty long and stable enough that the cell doesn't rely on passive dissociation. In fact, in order to get rid of this strand, to displace it from this good template, it recruits a helicase. You could have guessed this. So the action of a DNA helicase is going to come here. And when a helicase steps across this, because the backbone is discontinuous here and here, then this is displaced, right? So all helicase has to do is load here, move across, and this will dissociate. So the helicase that does this is UVRD. We used to think it was specific for NER, but it's going to show up in another repair pathway slightly later. It has a polarity, 3 prime to 5 prime. That wouldn't matter, really, only in terms of how it got loaded. And that UVRD action removes this top strand. So now we're in good shape because we're looking at something very common. We're looking at just a gap in DNA. Same old kind of gap that could be present in a replicating cell. And this gap then knows how to recruit polymerase and ligase because there will be a 3' hydroxyl right there left by UVRC, 3' hydroxyl, and a 5' phosphate. You could have predicted that. Because what has to happen after UVRC leaves is that this 3' hydroxyl has to recruit polymerase. And after polymerase fills in this gap, ligase has to act to restore the backbone. So again, polymerase and ligase are required because the nuclease that cut, that nicked the DNA, didn't store the energy of phosphodiesterone. Yes?
I was just curious, what stops the helicase from continually going?
That's a great question. What stops the helicase from continuously going on? If you were evolution and you were designing this, low processivity, there's a good idea. So it's not very low processivity by itself. It has cofactors that can make it higher processivity that we'll meet later. But it's actually not a very precessive helicase. It's not a hexamer, it turns out. So it doesn't encircle the DNA, and as a consequence, it doesn't stay tightly associated. It takes a few steps and it falls off. Good question, though? Excellent question. Okay, so NER. This process removed a 12 or 13 nucleotide oligo, or polynucleotide, in E. coli. And so people set about to look for this kind of thing in human cells, to find the human machinery that did this. No one found exactly this. But on a completely different front, there were discoveries that revealed how in us NER happens and how important it is for us. So it turns out that in eukaryotes, like us, what's removed is not 12 nucleotides. It's a little longer. It's 29 or 30. But it's the same process. There can be a DNA lesion, like a pyrimidine dimer here that's shown, intra-strand pyrimidine dimer, okay, that in the E. coli pathway that we just covered will be recognized by UVRAB, NICs added by UVRC, DNA UVRD helicase removes this, polymerase and ligase fill in. The same process happens in us, except that the recognition complex has a bigger footprint. And so when the nucleases are recruited to either side, now it's a 29 room that's released. Okay? So biochemically it was missed, but in fact the process is identical. So how did we discover the human repair machinery? It turned out that clinicians who were studying the molecular basis for an inherited cancer predisposition disease, xeroderma pigmentosum, or XP, mapped genes that were mutant in patients with this disease. In fact, different families had different mutations. But within a family, everybody that inherited the disease predisposition inherited the same mutant gene. And because there were big families, the clinicians could look to track what genes were co-inherited with the disease state. So the human machinery then was discovered as the genes that were mutant. Now, what's the phenotype of these people who have this disease? They lived, you know, complete darkness. They would have absolutely no phenotype. But when they go out in the sun, every part of the body that's exposed to the sun becomes covered in independent skin tumors extremely rapidly. So, you know, you can tell they wear V-necks or straight necks. It's a sun exposure syndrome. So when UV is present to induce those pyrimidine dimers and NER is not present, right, skin cancer is inevitably occurring. So thankfully, we have this nucleotide excision repair. You could wonder if some of us do it better than others. But, in fact, we know that many of us do it poorly because there's XP. So there turn out to be several genes, A, B, C, D, more. And these were actually identified as complementation groups. People took cells from patients with XP and made the cells fuse. And if the cells became repair competent, it meant that the mutations in the cells from the two different families were in different genes. So they defined these letters by complementation groups. And then they cloned the genes encoding them. So, XPA turns out to be a protein that's involved in recognizing the DNA damage and binding the DNA. So this is like UVRA, right? And XPC also does the same thing. So AC in XP is like AB in UVR. In fact, there had to be, you knew there were going to be at least one endonuclease activity because the nucleus is specialized for this process by interaction with the damage recognition proteins. So there has to be an endonuclease that specifically protein-protein interacts with that. Now, E. coli uses UVRC twice. Somehow, we specialize this, and we encode two different proteins. One cleaves at the 5' side, one cleaves at the 3' side. Okay? In addition, there's helicase subunits. These are shared with other helicase complexes. And there are probably rare variants that might be additional components of this complex. But here you can see already that we've got the machinery that E. coli has for doing this. Right? And they were found as genes required for UV light sensitive DNA damage repair. So similarly in yeast, in a model system that if any of you are in 110L, you are probably using, mutagenesis screens did the same thing. Yeast were screened, mutagenized, for strains that could grow absolutely fine if you leave them in a dark incubator. And if you expose them to UV light, they die. So these were called the rad genes in yeast because they're radiation protective. And there's a bunch of rad numbers that I can't remember offhand. So rad genes and XP genes. And the consequence then of not having UV 99 repair in us is skin cancer. Now there are other substrates that are also going to be repaired by NER in humans, probably others. But since we need sunlight to live, we need sunlight for, what, four of those vitamins that we make, this is a pretty common form of damage over our evolution, and mismatch repair has evolved to get rid of it readily. Nucleotide excision repair has evolved to get rid of it readily. Okay, questions on NER? Good. We're going to start mismatch repair, but we are not going to finish mismatch repair. Because mismatch repair is tricky. Up to this point, there's been a good strand, right? Base excision repair, NER. Those enzymes, all they had to do was recognize the damage, which takes some thought, but recognize the damage, recruit an endonuclease, right? And a phosphodiesterase or helicase, and get rid of the damage. Because there's an intact template strand left, and polymerase and ligase will come to it and seal the job. But starting with mismatch repair, it's more complicated. This mismatch is drawn here as these two little hats. Because this red strand and this blue strand, both of those strands are good info. By themselves, neither of those strands is damage. It is only the combination of these two strands that's a mistake. This can happen from misincorporation of nucleotides during replication. It can happen from deamination of 5-methyl C to T to create a GT base pair. It can happen with homologous recombination that we'll talk about in the next lecture. There are many events that lead to this situation. So in fact, mismatch repair isn't rare. It has to happen frequently. But for this not to be mutagenic, it would be nice to have information about which of these strands was the mistake. Which was the newly replicated strand, right? Or, sorry the hiccups. Or which is the strand that got deaminated. Okay, so there's mismatch repair machinery in E. coli. Read the slide. Because it's tricky, I'm warning you in advance. There's an ATP here. It's not one ATP. Okay. So these mute factors are the E. coli machinery. So mute, how did they get them? Like, this is a way to remember, right? If you have a mutator polymerase, if you have a mutagen that makes DNA replication inaccurate, right, and you throw that on E. coli, you can select for strains that will grow fine in that dark, comfortable incubator, but when you put in the mutagen will not grow. Whereas wild type cell, when you put in the mutagen, will grow. So genes were identified that conferred resistance to mutation through replication errors. And those were the mute proteins. So people still are trying to understand how this works because it's tricky. But in E. coli, we know part of the principle, at least. We know, in fact, in E. coli, that mismatch repair is sensitive to discriminating the newly replicated DNA strand. The evolutionary principle behind this is probably that most mistakes in E. coli that are mispairs are created during replication. So if immediately after replication, the strand that is newly replicated can be sensed, and that newly replicated strand will be the one that gets a nick and gets DNA removed and gets the other strand, the parental strand, gets used as template, that'll be the right way to go. Okay? And that's E. coli's evolutionary principle. So we're fortunate because in E. coli, we've already covered the mechanism by which mismatch repair could tell the parental strand from the newly synthesized strand, right? This is the third lecture where 6-methyl-A has come up. Now, 6-methyl-A, you'll remember, is not mutagenic. It's a mark that sits in the major groove side. Okay, and it's put there by DNA adenine methyltransferase, or DAM methylase. Okay? So in the parental DNA, each GATC, palindromic on the other side, GATC, each A has a methyl group. But immediately after replication, the blue strand, the parental blue strand, has a methyl group, and the new daughter strand doesn't, right? And this was intentional on E. coli's part, because it's part of the mechanism for preventing replication initiation in an uncontrolled manner, right? This hemimethylated GATC acts to delay DNA-A rebinding back to ORI-C, right? Because there are proteins that are going to compete for ORI-C. And so this, it's a replication timer, in a way, this hemimethylated state. And it takes, there's a little delay for DAM methylase to methylate the daughter strand. It will do so. It will take this hemimethylated DNA and return it to fully methylated, right? And then genome replication will return it back, and DAM methylase will turn it back, and right, so we have this cycle. But immediately after replication, this is very useful, because it's the strand without the methyl group that's the one that should be removed. And it's the blue strand that should be left intact to serve as template. So this is done, this is going to be done, by having a nuclease, an endonuclease, you knew this was coming, called MUT-H. Now, MUT-H is an endonuclease that can only nick the non-methylated strand. So it recognizes its sequence. It recognizes this very same sequence, binds it, but it cannot cleave the backbone here if the A is methylated. How could you accomplish that? Well, gee, maybe MUT-H discriminates the sequence in the major groove, and this methyl group projecting to the major groove prevents the active site from accessing the A. So MUT-H is a sequence-specific nuclease, but it's also highly specific for non-methylated sequence. We're going to use MUT-H in the reaction of this to introduce a nick, which is this purple box here in the backbone, on this red strand. Okay? Because as soon as MUT-H nicks this strand, it has marked the strand that's going to be removed. It's given access, okay, for entry points, for helicases and nucleases to remove the strand. So on this slide, it just says helicase and exonuclease. And what's indicated is this piece of DNA lifting off, you know, the red strand's gone here. And then all of our replication machinery can fill in a new red strand. But the reason this is drawn in kind of schematic cartoony here is that this mispair is not necessarily going to occur right next to this GATC sequence. Right? So it wouldn't work to have like a UVRA-like protein come and bind the mispair, and then through direct protein-protein interactions, just recruit MUT-H to sit next to it. That's not going to work, because you have to sense this signal wherever there's a GATC in the genome, and you have to fix this mispair wherever that mispair happened to occur. So there's a discontinuity drawn here in this slide, because we're going to have to deal with the fact that this and this can be far apart. This also makes mismatch repair a bit more expensive to the cell in terms of metabolic energy, because if the nick can only be put where the GATC site is, where the heavy methylated GATC site is. And the DNA, this red strand, has to be removed all the way back to this mispair. That's, in fact, quite a lot more DNA than had to get removed and replaced in NER, which was one nucleotide. I mean, BER, which was one nucleotide, sorry, and NER, which was 12 or 29, if you're in E. coli or humans, right? So, in fact, this is usually up to a KB. And so, down here on this final step, that length of DNA is going to need a precessive polymerase, like DNA Pol III. And because it needs a precessive polymerase, it needs all the polymerase's friends, single-stranded binding proteins, sliding clamps, clamp loaders, everything else, right? And also DNA ligase. So this part is going to be a little more extreme, but still it's what you know already. You know how Pol III loads on. You know how it moves. You know how it falls off and how ligase seals. Okay?
So it's just the proximity, whatever the word is, stops it from going, and it'll fall off eventually, and then it'll stop.
No, right, that's a good question.
Right next door,
right. Right. So we talked about, this is a really good question. Okay, so what is going to stop the Pol III from replicating continuously? Because it's precessive. And no, when it has a sliding clamp, it's not any less precessive. We talked about this activity called strand displacement. You guys remember this? Where if a polymerase loads here and starts moving, can it displace this base pair stuff downstream, right? And Pol III, turns out, doesn't strand displace very well. So in fact, when it runs into this stuff, it will stop. But we haven't gotten to the point yet where we make the single-stranded DNA, which I think is on the next slide. So, Pol III. The short answer to that question, which I will finish on Monday, is that Pol III doesn't go forever. Yeah.
So does lineage just do that every single time it recognizes GATC?
That's another good question, because that would be a problem,
yeah.
Right? Mute H, I just told you, it recognizes this and puts it in its active site, and it will cut any hemimethylated strand. And there are thousands of those, right? So no. Mute H is not activated to bind well to this sequence and to cut until it's bound to the proteins that loaded on this mispair. But the proteins that loaded on this mispair are going to travel before they activate mute H. And this is going to be the solution to the problem. So totally correct. Mute H doesn't wander around nicking. OK, so we can stop there. But I want to tell you that today, my office hours, as usual, are 11:30 to 1 over in LSA, 3:35. But next week, there's a faculty candidate talk at noon that I need to hear. So next week's office hours, 11 to 12 on Friday. If you can't make these, you can always email and set up an appointment. Oh, and I posted, for those of you who might have noticed this, on BSpace. You do not have to download these yet, but I posted the past three midterms and their answer keys that you can use as practice exams when you're studying in the future. Don't feel compelled to download them now, but they're there.